What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Brian Raftery, who is an author. He writes for The Ringer, does podcasts over there. He's written two books that I have liked quite a bit. Best Movie Year Ever, the films of 1999, perfect kind of retrospective of a very important year of my own, you know, kind of upbringing in terms of what was good and what was worth watching. And his new one, which is out this February, just in time for Valentine's Day, for any of the romantics out there, Hannibal Lecter, A Life. Very, very fun. Brian, thank you for being on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I want to talk about the genesis of this book, because it opens with a very interesting little vignette of the one and only Donald Trump talking about the late, great Hannibal Lecter, which was a thing for a while with him.
Yeah.
It was a real thing. He was going on and on about the late, great Hannibal Lecter and how everybody loved him. And it was one of, look, we live in weird times. There have been a lot of weird things that have happened. Donald Trump has said a lot of weird things. That was among the weirdest. Were you working on this book before that, or did somebody just say, all right, now we need a Hannibal Lecter book?
No, you know, the funny thing is, believe it or not, I think he had mentioned Hannibal Lecter maybe once, right? Once or twice before we signed the deal. And then within a month or two later, he went on the spree where he did it like three or four more times. So it was like, I get these texts from like my editor, from friends being like, oh my gosh, did you see he mentioned Hannibal Lecter again? And then by the end, no one's even bothering to text anymore. It's like, I mean, it came up in the Kamala Harris debate with him. It's like, it was basically 8 or 9 months where he, every couple of weeks, he would just, you know, Trump, when he read his stump speeches or listen to him, he's got his greatest bits. He's got his hits that he loves to do. And the late, great Hannibal Lecter thing just became this weird note that he kept striking over and over again on these very long campaign speeches, all of which I watched in their entirety while researching the book. And, you know, I have some theories as to why he was interested in Hannibal Lecter. I don't know the actual truth of what would make him repeatedly think this was something you want to talk about during an election year, but I mean, he won and I didn't. So he knows something, obviously.
He knows something. He's got some sort of a card in his pocket somewhere, but I do want to just hit on this real quick, because it's so weird and so fascinating. And look, I'm a guy who has been prone to doing the, you know who the real villain of the Karate Kid is, right?
Right,
it's Ralph,
right.
Macchio. He shows up, he's new kid in town. Like, yeah. I enjoy indulging in that sort of thing. I've never heard the case for Hannibal Lecter. That was a weird one. And so to like kind of repeatedly tie yourself to the one of the great psychopaths of the last, you know, 50 years of cinema was a real choice.
Yeah, I mean, to call him a wonderful man, which is very strange. I mean, I think it stems from a couple of things. One is, like, you know, it became clear at a certain point that Trump was talking about asylum and insane asylums, and somewhere in his kind of Trump brain, the, you know, Hannibal Lecter and the word asylum he was kind of connecting to immigrants seeking asylum, which really made no sense. I mean, he was making this case, he later claimed, that he was trying to tell everyone, oh, these people are coming in, they're seeking asylum, they're worse than people from insane asylums, which, again, you have to connect a lot of dots to really kind of understand that. But what's really interesting when you start thinking about these two men, one fictitious, one very real, both intimidating to me for their own reasons, you know, they are kind of weirdly cultural contemporaries. One thing I didn't realize until I started working on the book was that The Silence of the Lambs, the 1988 novel, and Trump's book, Trump, The Art of the Deal, were on the bestseller list at the same time. You know, they were kind of, in the 90s, I found a couple of gossip columns where there'd be an item about Donald Trump's Pizza Hut commercial, followed by an item about when's the next Hannibal Lecter book coming out. And one of the strangest things I found right toward the end of research, I kind of almost found it by accident, is that Trump and Melania actually went to the New York City premiere of Hannibal in 2001. And it's like, you know, it's all these huge stars. It's like Alec Alec Baldwin was there. You know, I think Lauren Bacall was there, and Trump was there. And according to these gossip reports at the time, like Page Six or Daily News, you know, he couldn't watch this scene where Ray Liotta's brain is eaten. So it's like there have been these strange inflection points where Trump and Lecter have kind of mingled in a weird way in the popular culture. But I also think, you know, Trump just loves pop culture. And when he's talking to an audience of boomers at like the Villages or whatever, it's like, yeah, you say Hannibal Lecter, they all know who it is. It gets an easy laugh or maybe an uneasy laugh. But why he kept saying it was the late great, which was very strange because I don't think, unless Trump was watching NBC's Hannibal, which I don't think he was. It does not strike me as his kind of show, where Hannibal possibly died at the end, though not really. You know, Hannibal Lecter is canonically still alive. So it was like the late and the great part made no sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny. We'll get to the NBC Hannibal, which I started watching in preparation for this conversation. Wow. I never watched it before. It's as good as everyone has told me, and I've been resistant, but we'll get to that in a second. So let's talk about enough Trump. Let's talk about your book. This is really a very small part of your book. It's not the main focus at all. So if you're just in this for the Hannibal Lecter of it all, you are in for a treat. The thing that I really appreciated about this, and was not expecting, frankly, to really appreciate, was the deep dive into the history of Thomas Harris himself, the author of Red Dragon, Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal, the other books in this series, as well as his first novel, Black Sunday, which I had never read. I didn't even really know about.
It's awesome. You'll love it. Like, you'll read it in like a week. It's such a great like airport thriller, and I don't use that term pejoratively. It's a fantastic thriller.
I gotta check it out. I gotta pick it up at Half Price Books. But the history here is really interesting. Tell us a little bit about Thomas Harris, because he's kind of reclusive. I'm sure you know you didn't talk to him for this, but you were able to track down lots of interesting little nuggets throughout history, the little breadcrumbs that he's left. What did you learn about Thomas Harris as you were researching and writing this book?
Well, the one thing I learned is that his commitment to being a recluse is basically lifelong. I mean, he's given, you know, Black Sunday came out in 1975. It's more than 50 years ago. In that time, from what I could tell, and from people I know who I talked to about this, he gave three like formal on the record interviews in 50 years. I mean, and I think he only did two because he had a new book coming out in around 2019. So he is truly like someone who is here. There's no footprint of him in terms of interviews, in terms of you can't go watch archival video, which I really admire. I mean, actually, in a way, it's kind of like he's one of the few actual kind of mysterious kind of cultural figures, because, you know, his books have sold something like 50 million copies. I don't know a single person who knows what Tom Harris looks like. I only do because like I've stared at his face for the last 2.5-3 years while researching. But I don't think most people would know, even people who've read all his books would really have an idea of what his life was like. And he was a guy raised in the South who became a crime reporter, first in the South and then later in New York City. And he decided to write this novel in the mid-70s when all these kind of newspaper guys were moving into novels. And it becomes Black Sunday, which was overshadowed by Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter, which was a really huge book. It was a bestseller. They made a movie with Bruce Stern in it, which was also a big Paramount production. And he basically was like this guy who decided to use all of his interest in crime and crime reporting and put it into his fiction, to the point where Red Dragon, the first Hannibal Lecter book, he went and talked to people at the FBI's behavioral science unit. And then he really researched more for Silence of the Lambs. So he's fascinating. And I knew from the get-go he wasn't going to talk to me. I mean, I put out a feeler to his agent, and it was a polite no. You know, at one point someone gave me an email address that used to work for him, and I kind of verified it, and I took a shot, and it was immediately bounced back. So I'm not sure if he's even like on email anymore. He's in his 80s and has not been, you know, public for a while. But he, to me, is fascinating because in some ways he is, you know, I don't want to equate him with Hannibal Lecter, but he's this guy who's traveled the world, who has very high-end taste, Tom Harris. You know, he's studied cooking in France. He's traveled everywhere. He goes to crime conventions. He knows all this stuff. And he creates Hannibal Lecter, who is, you know, the most high-end kind of serial killer of popular culture of the last, you know, probably of all time. And they're also both incredibly elusive figures in their own way. So Harris is fascinating to me. I loved reporting all this stuff. I loved writing about the publishing industry in the 80s, especially when it was like authors were getting like $250,000 marketing campaigns for a book. I mean, it's all that stuff was so rich and so wild to me. And again, I haven't heard a peep from him, and no one else has either in a long time. So for a guy like that to be so, to have such a public facing work and create a character who is in, who every single person in the country, I think, would recognize either on site or by a quote or two. And again, he's just, he himself is just, it's like Hannibal Lecter at the end of Silence of the Lambs. It's like Tom Harris has kind of wandered into this crowd and we just hear from him every 10 or 11 years or so.
It really, the $250,000 marketing budget is just an amazing fantasia for modern Arthur. I assume that you're, you know, with inflation and everything, you had at least $500,000 for this book, right?
Of course. I haven't checked the final figures yet, but yeah.
okay, good. But it is wild to read about his work as a crime reporter, because obviously that inflects a lot of what he ends up putting into his novel. And I don't want to, there is a warning against doing this. I think Harris himself said, don't necessarily do this, but there is kind of a real life Hannibal Lecter figure in his past that shows up in a pretty remarkable way.
Yeah. I mean, what's so interesting is, so because Harris has communicated so little with the public, I mean, again, only 3 interviews. He's done a couple of forewords and our author's notes for some republished editions. You know, there's very little about the actual genesis of Hannibal Lecter. At one point, he wrote an essay about for Silence of the Lambs, where he talked about, you know, when he was reporting, he did a lot of magazine crime writing in the 60s. And he went to Mexico and wound up, through a whole series of circumstances, wound up meeting this prison doctor. I mean, a guy who was working, helping these inmates, who he felt had a very kind of chilly manner to him, who stayed in his mind forever. And as he left the prison, the warden was like, oh, he's not a doctor. He's actually a prisoner here. He does take care of the prisoners, but he is actually an inmate here. And it turned out this was a guy who was accused of chopping up his lover and putting him in a box. And so this character became one of the many kind of like potential blueprints for Luther, for Lecter rather. I mean, they both had like maroon colored eyes, even that kind of thing. But when you look at he was so entrenched with the FBI during this kind of serial killer boom of the 70s, that to me, I think you have to look at the entire kind of run of mass murderers in Tom Harris's life to kind of understand who fed Hannibal Lecter. I mean, when he was a kid, or a couple years before he was born, there was a guy who was, you know, basically killed for being an accused cannibal in the South near where Tom Harris grew up. And that story became legend. So it's like, okay, it's a little bit of this guy from his youth. It's a little bit of this prison doctor he met. And then when he's talking to all his FBI agents in the 70s and 80s, they're dealing with people like, you know, Ted Bundy or Charles Manson. And I think there's this real interest on people to think, like, to wonder, well, who is the real Hannibal Lecter? And I'm not sure whether it's because it would be more comforting to know that he was based on a real person who's now behind bars and therefore he's just, you know, it can't be, or is more comforting to think that he's so wild that he never could have existed. But I think the truth is, you know, Hannibal Lecter is kind of like the end result of decades and decades and centuries of like mass murderers in this country, and the way they're written about and the way they're kind of lionized in a way.
Let's dive into this a little bit, because I do think it's interesting that, you know, the serial killer boom, which is a weird way to put it, but there does seem to have been this explosion of kind of serial killer cases, fascination with it, interest in it, that has kind of died off. I was looking at stats the other day. The number of serial killers has declined markedly in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, whether it's a function of easier to catch or different right. outlets or, you know, no lead in the pipes or whatever. Whatever the cause is, it seems to have slowed down somewhat. But there was this real stretch. There was this real stretch of time where there were tons of such killers. There was lots of coverage of them, and that is now kind of being mined for content, for lack of a better word, on, you know, by Netflix, by documentarians, by everybody. Everyone's like, who's the real life killer we're doing this week? Yeah. And that is weird. That's a weird thing. And I can't help but feel like Lecter is at least partly the genesis of that, or at least partly where some of the interest in terms of mass media comes from.
I think so. I mean, I certainly think from a pop cultural point of view, when you look at the Silence of the Lambs when it came out in 91, you know, right away, within a year or two, you have like Jennifer 8 and Blink. You have a lot of movies where it's like a young woman taking on some sort of killer. And then you have Seven, which I think kind of blows the kind of 90s serial killer thing even bigger. As I think, and I do think that because Silence of the Lambs wasn't just a great villain, because it was Clarice Starling, who is like such a great character in this movie and in this book, you know, I don't think Hannibal Lecter or that movie becomes as big without her. And I think the fact that Clarice Starling is an investigator, is someone who's curious in violent crime, who wants to make it their career, I don't think it's that much of a stretch to say that a lot of people who in the last 35 years or so have seen that character and thought, oh, I kind of want to do something like that. I am interested in crime, whether they become an FBI agent or whether they just become someone who listens to a lot of podcasts or hosts podcasts. But what I remember in the 90s is at a certain point, you know, I remember going to my mailbox one day in college and getting Spin magazine. And just a few months before, it had been, you know, Green Day or Perry Farrell, and Charles Manson was on the cover of Spin. And that was the same, I think it was the same year that like Natural Born Killers came out, which I had to see like opening weekend. And it was around the same time as, you know, there were all these like TV movies about serial killers. So at some point in the 90s, I mean, you know, true crime has always been a phenomenon, but in the 90s, for some reason, there was so much serial killer stuff going on that it just felt like pop culture. Like you almost, I'm not trying to be glib, and I'm not 100% sure what I'm saying is accurate, but it did feel like you kind of had to be up on certain serial killers the same way you kind of had to be up on certain like filmmakers or bands. And I think one of the things that I'd forgotten about before researching the book is that Silence of the Lambs comes out in February 1991. It plays in theaters for like almost a year. Within a few months of its opening, Jeffrey Dahmer is arrested. And then you have People magazine calling, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer a real life Silence of the Lambs on its cover. So there was right away this immediate link between this very kind of far-fetched on-screen character and in the reality. And all of a sudden, it seemed like the gulf between what was made up for a movie or a book and what was in real life was really shrinking. Because the Jeffrey Dahmer stuff, I mean, I had to go back and re-research some of that shit. It's horrific. And it's all like on the front page of the New York Times. It's not like in some tawdry magazine. It's like this is mainstream coverage of these incredibly grisly allegations and crimes. And it, to me, it just felt like everyone was kind of obsessed with serial killers for a while in the 90s. And now everyone's obsessed with them again, possibly 90s nostalgia, possibly like just, you know, a general cycle of true crime. But yeah, I do think Silence of the Lambs' success plays a big part in that.
Well, it's really interesting too, because I was, as I was jotting down my notes after reading this, the thing that jumps out is that you have there's this stretch of time in filmmaking, particularly that run of 90s movies. I mean, you could, you know, there's a million of them in the 90s, of the serial killer, the cop trying to catch a serial killer, you know, Seven, etc., like that whole genre. But it does feel like that type of killer became a monster, right? Like it was like you have Dracula, you have Frankenstein, you've got the Mummy.
Yeah.
Instead, now we have serial killers. The Freddy, Michael Myers boom kind of ends. That Friday 13th, that series goes into hibernation. Then you've just got a bunch of kind of standalone serial killer products, and that is it's a weird thing to have happened. It's a weird thing to have happened kind of organically.
And it's almost as if like the 80s kind of supernatural horror monsters just disappeared as soon as Hannibal Lecter showed up. It's not that as much of a one-on-one, but it is strange, like when you look back at the 90s and the list of films about these serial killers, and in these movies the serial killers post Lecter, they're all brilliant or methodical, or they're just like these misunderstood geniuses. When in reality, like most serial killers just are kind of like scumbags, like who have been lucky and to evade capture. You know what I mean? Like, I do think Lecter being so smart kind of convinced some people that like, oh, these are really interesting people who, you know, despite their flaws, have some real kind of intelligence. I mean, and that is true. And I think that, you know, I do think Lecter is, you know, the way he's written and the way he's portrayed, he is probably like, if you were going to be a serial killer, and I have no desire to be one, I'm guessing you don't either, like he's probably the one you'd want to be. I mean, like he's got good taste. People respect him. You know, he's funny. He's kind of, you know, he can be a real kind of like catty dude with some good one-liners once in a while, which is so far removed from when you read transcripts of interviews with like some of these guys who were just the most awful, you know, decrepit morons you've ever heard. So I do think Hannibal Lecter shined up the serial killer's reputation a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, again, it's really interesting. And I'm glad I read your book, Hannibal Lecter, A Life. It'll be, again, it's in stores right around the time for Thanksgiving. It's if you got a loved one you want to share it with, it's a nice little treat. But it's really interesting. And it is kind of fascinating how, Lecter helped spark some of this stuff. Another thing that's interesting, and you kind of trace this in your in your book is the public's relationship with the FBI. So in Red Dragon and in Silence of the Lambs, the FBI is seen as fairly competent, you know, like pretty a bastion of good effort and decency at the least. By the time Hannibal comes around, you know, you've had some stuff that has happened in the real world. You could talk about that. But the public opinion seems to have shifted quite a bit, and that is reflected in the book, right?
Yeah, and I think actually it's funny because the first three Hannibal novels, it's Red Dragon, The Silence of the Lambs, and Hannibal. I would say of the three, Hannibal is the one that I've reread the least and people I have the most kind of problems with. But I think it's the most culturally interesting of all three books. Just a big part of it, because what you just said, like, the movie, the Silence of the Lambs, the novel, came out in 1988. By the end, Clarice Starling has gone from like a naive trainee to like clearly she's on her way to become this, you know, if not a superstar at the FBI, then someone who's clearly solved this big case is on her way. And by the time Hannibal comes out in 1999, you know, the country has been through Ruby Ridge. It's been through Waco. There's this huge distrust of the government. The FBI's reputation in real life was kind of taking a few hits. And Clarice Starling is kind of like lost. She's lost in this bureaucracy. Her attitude isn't great. And it is kind of like, it's telling to me that Hannibal, the 1999 book, is the book where Harris apparently had the least amount of contact with the FBI. I think he was really kind of buddy-buddy with many people in the FBI in the 80s when he was working on Red Dragon and The Silence of the Lambs. But, you know, one or two people I spoke to in the FBI said he kind of dropped off in the 90s. And I think, you know, I'm not sure whether he was frustrated with the FBI and what they'd been through. I'm not sure whether it was just the fact that many of his contacts had left at that point. But yeah, Hannibal is a novel as like a snapshot of where how people felt about like kind of the greater kind of crime fighting apparatus of America is really interesting. I mean, it's also mostly a book about like a guy who breeds, you know, man-eating pigs to kill Hannibal Lecter. So it's not, you know, it's, I would not say it's a, you know, a in-depth examination of how America was feeling about, you know, bureaucratic law enforcement in the late 90s. But it is, like I said, it's an interesting kind of snapshot. And I think, you know, to its credit, even though some of those little storylines in Hannibal about Clarice go a little too long, like, you know, Harris really does kind of want to depict the era that the book's coming out in. He really wants to kind of try to capture the zeitgeist at that point.
Well, let's not underplay the man-eating pigs, because between this and Snatch, there was a real man-eating pig moment in the cultural history.
Oh, yeah.
Backlash, it was a good time. I don't know.
Yeah, it was definitely the Babe Pig in the City backlash. I think that really soured people, and they were like, "We love Babe. We don't like this sequel. We want to see some nasty pigs now." But I will say, you know, Hannibal does have one reason why Hannibal Lecter, I think, is so kind of seen, kind of treated as kind of this kind of tongue in cheek character, is that in all the books and all the movies, the other serial killer is so much worse. So by the time Hannibal the book comes out, you know, he's already had Buffalo Bill, he's already had the Tooth Fairy, who are these horrific monsters. So like Tom Harris is like, "All right, I'm going to create a villain who is a pedophile, who is hung out with Idi Amin, who's a gazillionaire," which is also kind of his own kind of criminal at that point, "and who's breeding man-eating pigs to get his revenge on Hannibal Lecter, because Hannibal Lecter fed him drugs and then forced him to cut off his own face and feed parts of his face to the dogs." It's like, that is a most like bare bones description of the most over the top villain I've ever read in books. And I kind of love it. I know people don't love Hannibal the book and there's problems with it, but I do love that character because it's so nuttily go for broke. I mean, it could only come out, as we were discussing, at the end of a decade where serial killers were on TV in prime time, like all the time. Like, how do you out-grotesque an already kind of grotesque culture? It's like, well, man-eating pigs and weird, creepy millionaires.
It is funny. The reaction to Hannibal was interesting because that was the first of the books I had read in real time, right?
Like,
I read
me
that
too.
When it came out.
Yeah, me too.
Because I was, you know, I was, I must have been 17 when that came out. So I was finally, you know, I was too young for the previous ones. And this one I read and really consumed very fast and was like, yeah, this is great. This is just as good as all, this right. is good as the other ones. And I went back and then I looked at some of the reactions. I was like, wait, people don't seem to like it. Isn't that, what has happened here? And the movie itself, I still have a very soft spot for the movie, which I like a lot, but I'm also a Ridley Scott guy. So, you know, there's a lot going on there that maybe I'm just making excuses for. But it is definitely, it's very different tonally. And part of the reason it's so different is because it does focus on Hannibal Lecter so much more than the other stuff. Did that kind of unbalance? It feels like the character has had kind of peaked right around then. Do we think that, or at least up to that point, had like they kind of it kind of hit a peak? Audiences got maybe a little more tired of him. Was there just too much Hannibal? Was that the thinking there?
I think so. I mean, you know, one of the appeals of Hannibal Lecter, both in Tom Harris's books and in the first two movie adaptations, Manhunter and Silence of the Lambs, is that he's so elusive. I mean, I think, you know, in Red Dragon, the novel, the first novel with Hannibal Lecter, I think he's in like 12 pages. You know, in The Silence of the Lambs, Anthony Hopkins is on screen for barely half an hour, if that. And there's large chunks of those stories where Hannibal Lecter is not even being talked about. And even when you get to Hannibal, the novel that came out in 99, you know, the first 100 pages, there's no Hannibal. It's all Clarice Starling. But then it becomes like hundreds and hundreds of pages of Hannibal Lecter hiding out in Italy, which is kind of fun. And then it becomes, well, let's get into Hannibal Lecter's backstory about his traumatized youth. And then the next novel, Hannibal Rising, which comes out like 2007 or 2006, is all about his youth. And I do think part of the appeal of his character was that he didn't hang around for too long. It's like, it's almost like the end of the Nightmare on Elm Street or Freddy or Michael Myers movies in Halloween. Like by the last one or two movies, like there's just so much of the killer where you're like, all right, I don't need to see this killer anymore. I don't need more and more backstory. And I do think they kind of went a little overboard with Lecter. And especially in the marketing of Hannibal, the movie, it's all just like, not only is it a lot of Lecter, but it's Lecter doing kind of like one-liners and quips, and he's kind of being turned into like a Freddy character. But I have a soft spot for the movie too. I don't love it, but I'm fascinated by it. And I think it's actually, like I said, the same as a book. It's one of the most interesting ones to talk about and think about because it's so of its moment. I mean, it's a 2001 movie that, you know, has a reference to Osama bin Laden, which is kind of wild. It's got the opening credits are all this surveillance footage. And you really get the sense that this is one of the first movies to really think about like kind of the surveillance state that America was really about to really become a true part of. So there's lots of interesting stuff in the movie that's not actually the movie itself.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Hurry into Menards right now and save big money. Miracle-Gro Raised Bed Soil helps you grow bigger, more bountiful plants. It provides the right foundation your plants need to thrive with a 100% organic formula that requires no mixing. Add Miracle-Gro Raised Bed Soil to help your plants grow with organic nutrients you can count on. Visit our garden center or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Yeah, for sure, for sure. So let's talk about the different Lecters here, because we've got three main. I'm gonna skip over Hannibal Rising just for apologies to the completists out there, but I have no interest in revisiting Hannibal Rising. So we're gonna go with Brian Cox. Brian Cox is the first. You talked to Brian.
I did,
Cox, Mr. Cox, for this book. What were some of his recollections of bringing that character to life? Because in Man, I feel like he's very much a small part of Manhunter and almost a plot device, and yet still pretty impressively chilling.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I spoke with him, he was really interested in Lecter's intelligence. And he was, you know, he told me that, you know, he did study Ted Bundy a bit at the time, and because Ted Bundy was, you know, had clearly, he'd been arrested and tried at that point by the time Manhunter was being made, but he remained in the media throughout the 80s for most of that decade. And the fact that, like, you know, Ted Bundy in Brian Cox's description was someone who was kind of charming in a scary way. And you got the sense that he could talk his way into people's lives. But he'd also, you know, Brian Cox had also been interested in a serial killer growing up as a child. He'd followed that trial. And so I think he was very much interested in, like, what are the real world analogs to this killer. And what I think is so interesting about Brian Cox's performance, and I think he has two scenes in that movie. I mean, he's barely in it. But first of all, the way he's shot is just like in this all white cell, wearing this all white outfit. It's a great Michael Mann visual kind of style for like, it's just, he's so, he has this crazy, you know, way, way, way pre-Succession, like dark black hair, slick back, and it's almost all you can see of him in the cell is just like this widow's peak in his eyebrows, and it makes him really kind of terrifying. But I also feel like what's so fascinating about Brian Cox in that movie is that he plays Lecter kind of catty, maybe a little bit bitchy if we use that term, but to me it always felt like he was playing Lecter as someone who was trying on a mask of what he thought a human being kind of talked like and acted like. Like he was so clearly sociopathic that he only could approach this from a way of like studying how humans behave. And Cox himself has studied serial killers, as opposed to Anthony Hopkins, who, you know, said in one interview, like he started a book on Ted Bundy and he's like, nah, I don't need this at all. Like he did not care about real life killers. He didn't want to research it. His whole thing was basically like, this is like, I'm like, what is really scary is someone who stares at you. And that's kind of like what his approach is in The Silence of the Lambs. You know, Anthony Hopkins had told this story about when he was a kid, he had a nightmare where he opened the door and someone was just staring at him from under a street lamp across the street. And so he really knew that like staring at someone intensely and not saying anything, like the, not to underline the silence of The Silence of the Lambs, but like that is what made his Lecter, I think, so scary in such a short amount of time. Also, you know, if you look at Cox and Hopkins, you know, Cox is behind these bars that Michael Mann put these beautiful white prison bars. Whereas in Silence of the Lambs, Lecter is staring like right at the screen. I mean, that's the way it's shot. Lecter and Starling's conversations, many of them are in a very jarring way. And believe it or not, as much as I love this movie, I've seen it a gazillion times. I had not seen The Silence of the Lambs in the theaters until 3 years ago because I was too scared to see it when it came out. Never. And when you watch in the theater on a giant screen with Anthony Hopkins looking like right at you, you do start like going down in your seat. Like it's very daunting to have someone's presence, like someone just kind of looking at you or making you feel that way. So I think those two performances, like, I couldn't pick a favorite. I love them both, but they do feel like very different interpretations of a kind of malleable character.
Yeah, Hopkins is interesting too because he definitely plays Hannibal Lecter with a sort of humor. There's certainly a humor there. There's a humor to it, but there's also there is also a real physicality that is absent from Brian Cox. But I mean, Brian Cox behind bars the whole time, so he's not, you know, jumping out and attacking people. But there is something very jarring about watching Anthony Hopkins of all people, you know, leap into a face. Like that is a crazy visual.
Well, it's also like he's so in Silence of the Lambs, like he's so all those scenes, early scenes in the prison or in the asylum, he is so restrained, like his clothes are so tight, like his posture is so rigid that when he finally just kind of goes on his killing spree and he still has that rigidity, it's like you do see him kind of loosen up a little bit. And in fact, one of my favorite scenes in the Silence of the Lambs, was never in the movie. It's one of my favorite deleted scenes of all time, but it's a great scene. And I get why they cut it, but I wish they hadn't. There's a great scene of Hannibal Lecter having made his escape from that, you know, kind of birdcage they kept him in. And he's driving this ambulance he's stolen and he's wiping blood off his face or whatever. And there's like a little bit of, there's a smile on him. And I think that's probably a little more of the Brian Cox mode of that character, like to kind of play at those emotions. But I do love that. It's such a cool visual of Anthony Hopkins with blood on him, smiling as he makes his getaway as Lecter. But I understand, you know, the more they kept him off the screen in that movie, the more powerful he was. So I get that choice of not having that scene in.
Yeah. Hopkins himself admits to being a little surprised by the popularity of the character, maybe even a little confused, which is kind of interesting. I don't know how many other actors would admit to that.
Well, I mean, I think he knew this was going to be a well-made film. I think he really trusted Jonathan Demme. But the thing that's so fascinating about Hopkins is like he has a long career. I mean, he really kind of has this kind of Gene Hackman filmography where it's like his classics are 100 like best, you know, like absolutely the best movies, and then tons of paycheck stuff. And by the time he got offered Silence of the Lambs, he had kind of resigned. He had tried to make it in Hollywood. He'd gotten some good parts, but nothing really, like he'd won some Emmys, but he was not going to be a movie star who gets like a big prestigious movie. So he had kind of like resigned to living in England and doing stage and TV. And so when it took off, you can tell he was really surprised. And one thing that surprised him was like people kept coming up to him and saying like, why do you think Hannibal Lecter does this or that? And he's like, I don't know. He's sort of like, I just played the guy. I don't know why someone would actually eat another human being. But one thing that one of the most delightful things I found, and it's not a word I use a lot while talking about Hannibal Lecter, but while researching the book was Jonathan Demme, the director, his archives are in Michigan. And so there's all this Silence of the Lambs stuff. I mean, it's amazing. It's like just 13 boxes of memos and faxes and scripts. And one of them was a transcript from a call-in radio show in Los Angeles that Anthony Hopkins went on right after Silence, when the movie was basically blowing up. And there were women calling in saying, like, hey, could you say hello, Clarice, to me? Like, could you, like, basically just sort of like, there was this kind of weird sex appeal to Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter, which is kind of funny. But when you watch it, you're like, he's pretty commanding. Like, he's in his early 50s. But he's like, you know, he's maybe losing some hair, but like, he is kind of commanding and he's very charismatic in a very strange way. So I could see that, but I think everything about this movie kind of surprised him. I don't think anyone was expecting it to be what it wound up being. And again, even though they were all very confident in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we come to Mads Mikkelsen. So of course there's the Hannibal TV show. It runs on NBC from, I think, 2013 to 16.
Only a 3-year like run. That. Yeah. Three seasons, three really small seasons.
Only three seasons. And it, but it's like I said, I just started watching it to prep for this, and it is really interesting to watch because it gets at it gets at a thing that is kind of hinted at by Cox and Hopkins, but is given more space to breathe here, obviously, because it's TV, which is the idea of Hannibal Lecter as a button pusher, as a guy who is trying, who is not scary because he is gonna eat your nose off your face, right? He's scary because he can get in your head and make you do things that you do not necessarily want to do, and that he has his own design, that he's doing these things of his to either amuse himself or to learn more about human nature. And that does seem to be the most interesting aspect of Hannibal as a character, right?
I think so. And it's like, you know, what's so fascinating about that show is you're watching it now. I started it, I put that show off for a while because I was just like, I love these, like, what are you going to do with Hannibal Lecter? And I really felt like it was just like, I'm not going to watch this show. This is another cash in. And when it started, I think I just had my first kid, and I watched the first couple episodes and I was like, this is actually really good, but it's way too, I mean, it's an incredibly dark show. And I was like, I'm just not in the mindset for it. So when I finally watched the whole thing, I'm working on this book. I mean, I do think this interpretation, what Brian Fuller, who created the show and wrote a lot of the episodes, what I think he does so well is really, like, it is the most, I think, humanizing portrait of someone who is a true outsider. That's what I think that show does so well. Like, you know, he's played by a European actor, which already kind of sets him apart. He's dressed in these beautiful, crisp suits and making these incredibly elaborate meals, you know, while also ducking into these crime scenes where people are just dressed as regular cops. And he clearly thinks and acts and speaks in ways that are, it's kind of like, wait, what are you talking about? He's a little bit off, but he's really likable and he's very engaged with every character. And I do think he's probably the most pro-human version of Hannibal Lecter. Like, I do think he actually likes people and wants to be walk among them and understand them. And I just think he also occasionally likes to eat them when it fits his purpose, when it suits his purposes. And I do think it's like that. I do think that adaptation is so remarkable, not only because how insanely gory it is for network TV, but having just reread all these books multiple times before I started going through the whole series, you know, Brian Fuller really does this trick that very few screenwriters can do, where he is so faithful to Tom Harris's books. I mean, there are tiny little details that no other screenwriter would keep. He really takes all these stories from these different books, he blends them together, but it's also completely his own idea for what this character should be. It's a really true kind of like, it feels like it was a partnership with Tom Harris, even though Brian Fuller never spoke to him. It's like one of the best adaptations, I think, of any kind of popular literature is that TV show.
Well, it's really interesting to watch because I'm midway through the first season right now, but as I am watching it, and it's been years since I've read the Harris books, though, again, I've rewatched the movies enough to know them more or less by heart. What's interesting is it reminds me. Did you ever watch Fargo? Not the movie, not the Coen Brothers movie,
I watched
Noah Hawley.
Yeah, that's TV another show? Yes. Which I think I was hot and cold on some seasons, but those first 2 years, I absolutely loved it. Yeah.
And he seems to be doing Brian Fuller seems to be doing something very similar to what Hawley was doing there, which is that he, you know, Hawley was pulling not just from Fargo, but like all different parts of the kind of Coen brothers oeuvre. Like he was putting little bits and pieces in. And that is very much what it feels like. Again, at least through this first, you know, five or six episodes, like characters show up who are the same, and there's killings that are kind of the same, and there's little, but it's all different. It's all rearranged in a really unique, interesting way.
Yeah. I mean, my only complaint with the TV show, aside from the fact that sometimes it's so gross that I'm like, oh, I don't have lunch today. But like, Hannibal is so weird that there's times he shows up at these crime investigations and you're like, wasn't anyone in the FBI kind of like, let's not call Hannibal in. Like, do we need this guy? Like, he just kind of stands around and asks questions. Like, sometimes he's a little too easily integrated into like this formal police organization where I'm like, would they really want to hang out with him like after work? Like, he's really kind of odd. But I agree. Like, I do think Fargo is a very good comp for someone who loves a piece of work or a body of work and wants to kind of continue it and pay some sort of homage without just doing fan service. You know, it definitely feels like those creators really studied what made those original works so effective.
The humanizing aspect of Hannibal here, which is something we're not dancing around, but it's there and I think worth digging into. You know, I have colleagues who believe that one of the reasons we live in this kind of Donald Trump era is that, amongst other things, the world of media, the world of TV, the world of film has kind of created these anti-heroes that everybody is, you know, kind of secretly cheering for, your Tony Sopranos or your Don Drapers or whatever, like the bad guys who you kind of like. And Hannibal kind of fits into that, less so in the movies, I think a little more with the TV show maybe. But there is that kind of, you know, are we cheering? Do we cheer for these people? And should we be? And does that impact how we see the world? I am torn on this. I go back and forth on it. It's I have not made up my own mind. I'm curious if you've thought about this at all in the context of Hannibal in our moment. Like, what does it mean? What does it all mean?
I have thought about it a bit. For me, one thing, it's like, I just think of like how far back anti-heroes go. I mean, whether it's like HUD or whether it's like Boba Fett, like I've always liked the wrong people in movies. Like, I very rarely, there's very few like straight up heroes that I've really loved in film or books. I always have loved people who are a little screwed up or a little dark, not always necessarily villainous. But to me, they've just always been more interesting. I do think that there is something going on that's a little mushy brain now, where we are so used to the bad guys being cool that we do sometimes start to like, apply that to real world human behavior, where it's like, ah, so-and-so is just being the heel of this story. And I'm like, well, these aren't all, yes, these are stories, but they're not like fictitious narratives that we're kind of assigning these kind of like really virtuous or kind of cool or ironically cool attachments to certain heroes. But I don't know if that means that, I don't know if I'd put the responsibility necessarily on people who create these stories. I just think that everything just comes now through a screen. And so we have, in some weird way, not lost our ability to tell what's real or what's not, but it just feels like it's a little more porous. And, you know, when you can kind of morph a fictitious character literally to look or talk like a real person, you know, whether using AI or just through joking, or, I mean, I don't know. There does feel like there is some kind of boundary now where it's like, oh, so-and-so isn't the good guy. I mean, that's kind of the weird thing about, you know, I did this book on 1999, and the weird thing is talking to people for years and years about Tyler Durden. And it's like, oh, Tyler Durden's awesome. Like, I have a Tyler Durden tattoo. And I was kind of like, yeah, look, Brad Pitt in that movie, no human male has ever looked better on screen. He's super cool. He wears that awesome bathrobe. I'm like, but he's not a good guy. That's the thing. It's like, I think ultimately what all these stories prove is that charisma at this point is possibly more powerful than actual good deeds or altruism. Like, I do think that charisma, being able to look into the camera, talk to people, make them feel seen, maybe give them a wink, make them feel like their own bad impulses are okay. I do think that is something that's kind of like happening right now. We're seeing a little bit in the real culture.
Yeah. The extent to which, like, this is one of my big things, and I stress it all the time, is the extent to which the way you consume a thing changes how that thing is perceived. And the fact that we consume everything now, from interactions with friends and family to the news to whatever through the same screen in a lot of cases, through this, through my laptop screen, cannot help but change how we think about all of these things. And that is not, that's not ideal. All right. That was pretty much everything I wanted to ask about your book. I got through where there's so much there. It really is interesting. It's really interesting if you're a fan of The Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter. But it's also just really interesting, as you said, about a story about the world of book publishing as it existed from 1975 or whatever through, you know, through now, through the lens of this one not at all prolific author. I mean, you can see the shift in the entire industry through the kind of epochs in which he like actually publishes.
Which is kind of
interesting. What did we not discuss that we should have? What did we not talk about that you think folks should know about either your book or Hannibal Lecter or the world at large?
Oh, wow. Well, there's a lot of things we could talk about. I mean, I guess the one thing is like, just like for people who are listening, who I assume are movie fans, like, and this is the most nerdiest movie fan thing, but like the real joy of this whole project was, as I mentioned earlier, being able to go to University of Michigan and like go through all these files and files of Silence of the Lambs material. And it really, first of all, anyone who's a movie fan who loves a movie the way I love Silence of the Lambs, I hope they all get to experience a day like that where someone just says, here's 13 boxes with everything you've ever wondered about this movie, go crazy, which was wonderful. But it also, like, I think kind of reaffirmed for me, just, I got to be honest, like, I go on TikTok and I go on Instagram and I follow a lot of really smart people, yet I'm still getting served up total nonsense, bullshit, pop culture facts. It's always like, did you know that so-and-so turned down the script of blah, 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 blah. And it's like IMDb trivia. And one thing that like this whole experience has really made me appreciate is just the authors and people or people such as yourself who are interviewing actual filmmakers or people who care about this stuff. Like, there's so much misinformation now about movies. It used to be like misinformation was something you thought about, like, you know, some about politics or about science or something. You're being told a lie about the government. But now it's like, there's so much erroneous information. Like, a TikTok popped up like 2 weeks ago where some kid was like Jodie Foster screwed over the producers of Hannibal, that movie, by leading them on for 10 months that whether she and wanting $30 million. And I was like, none of this is true. And so I think one thing has made me, my lesson from all this is that I had so many great librarians help me with this book and researchers and archivists and like, please, like, they're like, whenever you can get actual primal, like, primary sources, like, more than ever, even now with something as goofy as, like, the story of Hannibal Lecter, like, there's so much misinformation out there. I have no idea why I chose that to be our spiel, but it was just, that's the first thing that came to mind.
No, it's true. This is 100, read books. Books are, books
like,
have
do you
good
get all
information
these, like,
in them.
Do you get all these, like, pop culture Instagram accounts suggested to you where it's, like, movie facts, 90s, and I'm, like, and then there was one that, like, had a thing about, like, I think they kind of stole something from my 99 book, but they got it wrong. And I was like, you didn't even steal that quote correctly.
If you're going to steal it right.
Yeah. I'm like, seriously, I don't care if you steal it. Like, take all you want. I wrote it so people can read and use it. But yeah, anyway, that's become my strange, completely inconsequential soapbox of the last couple of months is just the amount of pop culture misinformation.
I'm totally with you. There's one account on Twitter. I can't even remember the name of it, but it had this habit of doing these long threads, and it did one about the Terminator. And Gail Ann Hurd, who was one of the producers on the Terminator, hopped into the thread, was like, "This is wrong. This is wrong. This didn't happen like this. That amount of money is wrong." Yeah. Like, just like going through the whole thing, and I blocked that account. I was like, I don't want this in my life anymore. I'm done with this.
I think Vincent D'Onofrio just did that a couple of weeks ago. Someone was tweeting about Full Metal Jacket, and he's like, "Yeah, that never happened." I'm just like, I think Vincent D'Onofrio remembers what happened in the scene starring Vincent D'Onofrio better than like Movie Facts Biz or whatever the hell it is.
I don't know. Yeah. Can you really trust an actor who was there? That doesn't sound right.
Sometimes you can't.
The internet is telling me one thing. All right, Brian, thank you so much for being
thank
on
you,
today.
Man.
I really appreciate it.
This has been awesome.
And again, the name of the book is Hannibal Lecter: A Life. It's here's the cover. I don't know if we'll have video on this, but if we do, here's the cover. It's a really quick read. It's only 300 some pages, and it's full of good, interesting, useful, and true facts, which is...
Oh, I'm sure I got something wrong, and I'll hear about it right away, but I tried not to. I tried my best to tie it all up, but yeah, but thank you very much.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Nobody does it better than Regent Seven Seas Cruises. Enjoy all-inclusive, unrivaled luxury with unlimited shore excursions, indulgent cuisine, personalized service, and more aboard spacious all-suite ships. Visit rssc.com to experience the unrivaled.